WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Gail Harris, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Well, there's no mystery about whom the Democrats are going to pick at the convention in July to take on President Bush in November. Massachusetts Senator John Kerry has been all but anointed. What's still unknown, though, is whom Kerry will choose for a running mate. Tonight on Point, the huge VP question in Kerry's future. But first, we begin with today's violence in Iraq. Five U.S. soldiers were killed today when a bomb exploded under their vehicle west of Baghdad. And in a separate attack in downtown Fallujah, a mob attacked a group of foreign contractors and fatally shot four people. Thanasi Kambanis is Baghdad correspondent for the Boston Globe. I ask him what he has learned since this morning about both attacks.
Well, the first attack happened early this morning, and that was several miles outside of Fallujah, and that was a roadside bomb which killed five soldiers. And that's the actual single deadliest attack on U.S. Soldiers since January, when January 8th, when a Black Hawk helicopter was shot down. Later in the day, apparently from the reports we have now, two SUVs that were carrying contractors, three Americans and one other foreign national, were driving through downtown Fallujah. They were ambushed by gunfire and perhaps RPG fire, according to witness reports. And after the cars were stopped, it's unclear whether the contractors in them were dead at this point. A crowd gathered around them and set the cars on fire. This is where it got more gruesome and more disturbing than anything we've seen so far in the last year in Iraq. The crowd pulled some of the bodies out of the car in footage from some of the TV cameramen, you can clearly see what looks like a blonde foreign man, perhaps wearing dog tags, lying on the ground by one of these SUVs, and then they pour fuel on the fire, set the cars and the bodies on fire, and then afterwards they're kicking the charred bodies. One of them they dragged behind a car through the center of town, another they dragged by the legs, and they hung two of the bodies from the main bridge over the Euphrates in downtown Fallujah.
You know, it sounds so much like that horror scene from Somalia about, 10 or 11 years ago when a mob dragged the body of an American soldier through the streets of Mogadishu.
I mean, for understandable reasons, that's a comparison that the U.S. military here is loath to see made, and the major difference, of course, is that these were civilians and not soldiers who are being dragged through the streets. And obviously the other reason why they don't like that comparison is because the Somali incident prompted the American withdrawal from Somalia. Today they've been very vocal in portraying themselves as unwilling to stand down or buckle in the face of what they call, you know, pressure from a small sliver group of insurgents. They say the contractors working here, as well as the military personnel, are well aware of the risks and committed to the mission of rebuilding Iraq, and they do not want to be seen as crumbling under the pressure created by these attacks. Now, the other reality, as far as we can see from the reports, is that no U.S. military and no Iraqi police went to the scene of this sort of mob carnage in Fallujah for hours afterwards. At 5 o'clock this afternoon, which was about 7 hours after the attack, a U.S. military spokesman said he believed Marines might be on the way at that point. And certainly in the early afternoon, there was no presence in the town. That contradicts reports that Fallujah is under control of the U.S. Marines who are in that area.
Well, and in terms of the makeup of this mob, do we know if these are Saddam loyalists or Islamic fundamentalists? And does that kind of distinction really matter anymore?
It certainly matters to understanding what one is dealing with here. The U.S. military and the occupation officials here like to classify the violence we're seeing in terms of foreign terrorists and Saddam loyalists. Now, when you look at the crowd that was gathered in Fallujah today, there were lots of young teenage boys chanting, "Long live Fallujah," chanting, "We will give our blood and souls to defend Islam." They did not look like any sort of organized militia, and frankly, the crowd that did what it did to these bodies is not necessarily linked to the people who did the ambush. So what that shows is that there was a group of hundreds of teenage Fallujah men who were just thrilled to see foreigners killed in their town. And if anything, that suggests there's popular support for resistance by parties who aren't either Saddam loyalists or foreign terrorists.
And if you will, Thanasi, remind us what makes Fallujah such a dangerous place to begin with. We've known for some time now that this is one of the real hot spots in Iraq.
Fallujah was a town that benefited greatly during Saddam's regime from the Ba'ath Party rule. It's also a place with very deeply rooted tribal identities, and these are tribes that live by a code of honor that requires all the male relatives to 5 degrees to avenge any act of violence upon a member of the tribe. So even removed from politics, it's a place where feuds can quickly spiral out of control. So you combine that with the Ba'athist loyalty in this area, and it was, you know, the heartland of the Sunni triangle where Saddam had his deepest support. That's why since May of last year, Fallujah has probably been the hottest place for U.S. soldiers.
We're told that this was the single worst attack against non-military foreigners since the conflict began, and I wonder what this tells us, or tells you, since you're there on the ground, about what might be likely to happen between now and June 30th when authority is handed over, presumably, from the U.S. to the Iraqis.
We've been told to expect an upswing in violence, an upswing in attacks against civilians and foreigners as well as against the U.S. military. I think lots of us were taken off guard today by the apparent joy of this crowd that was doing something horrifying and sort of hair-raising to see. And I think the question in everyone's mind is not only will there be a lot more attacks in the coming months before the power transition, but will we see an outpouring of violence at a different level affecting, you know, as it's been now, contractors, missionaries, Iraqi police? Are we about to see something where bloodthirsty mobs begin to change the entire tenor of and balance of power on the streets of Iraq?
Well, we hope you can stay safe and keep your head down, Thanasi. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Gail. Take care.
Thanasi Kambanis is Baghdad correspondent for the Boston Globe. He spoke with me from Iraq. Just how important is picking the right running mate? Well, ask George McGovern. In 1972, he named Missouri Senator Thomas Eagleton to the ticket. Shortly after the convention, Eagleton revealed that he had been hospitalized for depression and had received shock therapy. Well, at first, McGovern said he supported him 1,000%, but a few weeks later dropped him. McGovern went on to lose to Richard Nixon. And you could also ask the first President Bush. He was urged to dump Dan Quayle after the first term. He didn't, and then lost to Bill Clinton. So a lot is on the line for John Kerry in the VP sweepstakes, and he's taking his time making that decision. Tonight on Point, the VP question in Kerry's court. Should he pick a running mate soon or wait until closer to the convention? If you could advise John Kerry, what would you tell him about choosing a running mate? What experience should a vice president have in these times of war, terrorism, and economic uncertainty? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And joining me now from Washington is Paul Light, presidential scholar at New York University and author of Vice Presidential Power. Welcome, Paul.
Hey, it's nice to be here.
Well, it's good to have you with us. And with me in the studio is Jack Beatty, our On Point news analyst and a senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. And always a pleasure to have you, Jack.
Always a pleasure to be on with you, Gail. And hello to our guest.
Well, let me start with Paul. If the book is called Vice Presidential Power, I'm assuming, Paul, you didn't mean it as an oxymoron.
Well, first of all, thanks for not identifying me as a vice presidential scholar. I try to reach more broadly in my career now. I wrote this book back in 1984 at the urging of a senior colleague who I think wanted me to disappear kind of with the subject. Vice presidential power is just a play on the notion that vice presidents today have all the perquisites of office. They have all the access to information that any senior advisor does, but all it gives them is a license to persuade. And their ability to persuade the president depends on the quality of their argument, the strength of their intellect, the president's willingness to listen. I mean, you can't kick the vice president out of the West Wing. You can't take away his or her aircraft. But you don't have to take their advice, and that's the point of vice presidential power.
Is it a job now that is more important than it has been perhaps historically? We heard the John Nance Garner quote earlier about the value of the job, but is it truly important now who's occupying that number two slot?
Well, you know, at the end of the day, there's only one thing the vice president has to do, which is be there should something happen to the president. Lyndon Johnson used to say that he felt like a vulture every time he went in to see Jack Kennedy, and the job itself is still very constrained. The fact is, though, that presidents are dealing with a much more uncertain world. Vice presidents have a significant staff complement. They do have access to resources now that they didn't used to. And, you know, a president who's kind of thinking about how to make good decisions is going to turn to the vice president at least once in a while, unless the vice president somehow creates an image of himself or herself that's, not particularly trustworthy or not particularly somebody the president wants to talk to, a la Dan Quayle.
And doesn't it also give us a real hint as to how a president might make decisions?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, look, at the end of the day, the choice of your vice president is not going to win you the election. I mean, it might hurt you. And in fact, presidential candidates really do look at the damage that can be done from a bad pick. Back in 1968, Nixon did quite a bit of polling and found that he would have been better off running alone rather than with a VP. And so he picked Spiro Agnew, who was just about as alone as you could get. So, you know, the vice president's not going to help you, but it's a critical decision, and it's often the only decision that the presidential candidate's going to make that's going to kind of show the public what he or she's made of. Now, Mondale did it, certainly used the choice of Geraldine Ferraro back in 1984 to make a clear statement that, you know, he was bold, he was going to try something new, and it really did shake up the electoral deck, and the Reagan people had to respond. And John Kerry can do the same thing here. It's really one of the few decisions that he'll make this year that's really important. And George Bush may face a similar challenge later this summer, early fall, in terms of keeping Dick Cheney or possibly replacing him.
Well, hold that thought, because I do want to get into that in greater depth as we go along. We just have a few minutes before we have to take a break. And Jack Beatty, I'm curious, who gets your vote as to who made a really good pick?
Well, I think 1960 is the year that people usually cite that picking Lyndon Johnson really made a difference. Now, I think Johnson brought the South, some people credit him with as much as 80-plus electoral votes if you throw in other Southern states, and Kennedy's margin was 34. Now, you could say that those are the days of the solid South, and the Democrats would have carried those places anyway, perhaps. But there was also some electoral, if not chicanery, something pretty close to it in Texas, as I remember. And Johnson had a long history of that kind of thing. He won in 1948 by pretty much stuffing a ballot box. And some of that, some people think, went on in Texas. So that, I think, was a real case of it helping.
And Paul, in a few words, what's the best argument for why Kerry should make that choice now? Because doesn't it take away from some of the enthusiasm and the charge such as it may be, that goes with political conventions in the summer?
It's a way for him to shake things up right now, show that he's a strong decision maker at a moment when George W. Bush is under fire for being a weak decision maker or a confused decision maker. So one could argue it's an opportunity to show his strength and contrast himself with a president who's under fire.
All right. We're going to continue our conversation in just a moment after we take a break. We're talking this hour about the big vice presidential question in John Kerry's future. What would his choice say to you about his presidential decision making? And what do you look for in a vice president? Do you look at the whole ticket, or is it just about the man at the top? We invite you to join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Gail Harris, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook, and we're talking this hour about options and cautions for John Kerry as he goes about picking his running mate, the politics, the personalities, and the high-stakes gamble in the VP sweepstakes. In 1988, George H.W. Bush was criticized by many for picking Indiana Senator Dan Quayle as his running mate. Here, Quayle defends himself against charges of inexperience in the vice presidential debate with Democratic Senator Lloyd Benson.
I have far more experience than many others that sought the office of vice president of this country. I have as much experience in the Congress as Jack Kennedy did when he sought the presidency. I will be prepared to deal with the people in the Bush administration if that unfortunate event would ever occur.
Senator Benson.
Senator, I served with Jack Kennedy. I knew Jack Kennedy. Jack Kennedy was a friend of mine. Senator, you're no Jack Kennedy.
Again, that was Vice President Dan Quayle and Democratic vice presidential nominee Senator Lloyd Benson mixing it up at the 1988 VP debate in Omaha, Nebraska. And now it's John Kerry's turn to pick a running mate. So who tops your list for the VP slot? What qualifications are you looking for in a vice president? And what will Kerry's pick say to you about his presidential decision-making skills? We invite you to join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And we're talking this hour with Paul Light, who is presidential scholar at New York University, also the author of Vice Presidential Power, and with On Point News analyst Jack Beatty. That is such a memorable clip from that 1988 debate, gentlemen. And it does make me wonder, Benson was a safe choice. Is that the way to go, Paul? Let me start with you. Or is this a time when you want to make a bold choice?
It really does depend on the election context. In the case of Mondale in 84, he was so far behind. The electoral circumstances really favored Reagan's reelection. He had to do something to get the public's attention again. He was fading. So he makes a very bold choice. It's risky, high yield, high risk. So the context is important. Now, John Kerry and George Bush are kind of neck and neck right now. Does it really make sense to use this particular choice at this particular moment to say, hey, I can really make a big, bold decision? Does Kerry want somebody on the ticket that kind of evens things out or helps create a larger target space for the Republicans? I just don't know. I predicted back in 84 that Mondale would never choose anybody before or would never announce before the convention, and I thought he'd pick somebody like Biden or Bradley or any one of a number of B-named politicians. I was completely wrong, and I hate to make a prediction here. But I'll tell you, this particular decision could shake up the election context quite dramatically, especially if Bush decides to keep Cheney on the ticket.
Jack, do you see this as being primarily about geography? I mean, is it wise to go with somebody who's going to help you with a particular region of the country, or do you want someone who is going to be more broadly appealing to the entire country?
Well, you know, in the secession crisis of 1861, just as he was being sworn in, Abraham Lincoln desperately had to keep the border states in the Union. And someone said to him, is God with you, Mr. President? He says, I don't know whether God is with me, but I have to have Kentucky. Well, you know, it seems to me losing Florida by 567 votes, you have to have Florida. And just think. If Al Gore had picked Bob Graham, I mean, we're going to talk about this, but, you know, I've seen studies, I don't know how they disaggregate this, that was worth 2 to 3 points in Florida. Well, of course, he only needed a nose. So I think this year, these sorts of, you know, big statement or, you know, Vice President Bush went for youth and for woman, for Vice President Mondale. I think people have got to be thinking about the electoral votes this time since Gore was just 4 votes off.
Let's hear from one of our callers on a similar point. Kevin's on the line from Fall River, Massachusetts. Hello, Kevin.
Hello, yes. Yes,
I'd suggest to Kerry, who knows, you may be listening, the Senator Graham from Florida. He was, I believe, on the Intelligence Committee, if I'm not mistaken. He was clear and unequivocally against this war for all the right reasons. He's not a Northeast liberal at all, and yet he's was both senator as well as governor, I believe, of Florida, which is the battleground state. It's the biggest battleground state by far and the most closely contested, if we go by the last election. So I think that he would be an excellent vice presidential candidate and could very well determine the election.
All right, Kevin. Well, we thank you for the call, and we want to follow up on that point. I want to bring into the conversation now S.V. Date, who is Capitol Bureau Chief for the Palm Beach Post in Florida. He's also the author of a new book, Quiet Passion, A Biography of Bob Graham. Hi, S.V., and thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So is this the logical choice? I mean, you just heard Kevin make his argument.
Well, it's funny because that was obviously a question that came up as I was researching this book. One of the folks I spoke with was Congressman Mark Foley, who for a time now was running for Graham's seat last summer. His opinion was, yeah, Graham would have brought 100,000 votes to Gore, and he'd be running for re-election right now.
Hmm.
So, I mean, there are plenty of folks in Florida, Republicans included, who think that Graham on the ticket would probably shake things up down here.
Well, also, talk to us about Bill Nelson. That's another name that seems to be on the short list or some short lists.
And I'll be honest, that it puzzles me a little bit. I hear that that he's considered to be, well, more attractive because he's younger. Well, he's not that much younger, maybe 6 or 7 years. Further, he's only had one statewide election of consequence. That was in 2000 when he ran for the U.S. Senate. Prior to that, he'd served 6 years as the state insurance commissioner. Now, all told, including those two easier races, three statewide runs, an average margin of victory of 7 points. Bob Graham has had five statewide runs, two of them for governor, which are very high profile, three of them for U.S. Senate, which are very high profile, our average margin of victory of 22 points. So in those two areas, it seems to be a no-brainer. In terms of experience, Graham was a governor for two terms. And Nelson wasn't. Nelson ran for governor once in 1990, but lost in the primary to Lawton Childs. And in terms of the politics of it, now, if you were to win and Nelson is the running mate, well, then Jeb Bush picks the successor for 2 years. If it's Graham, that doesn't happen. It's not an issue now since he stepped down. So for a number of reasons, I've never quite understood the buzz on Nelson, but you know, that's just me. Other people might disagree.
I don't know if you were with us earlier when we heard the clip from Lloyd Benson, the famous "You're no Jack Kennedy" quote. And I'm wondering how important it is to have a vice president or vice presidential nominee who can be the attack dog on the campaign and allow the candidate for president to look very presidential. I mean, is that something you could see Bob Graham doing?
Well, that's something Bob Graham has been doing for getting on 2 years. If you remember, he made that famous blood on your hands speech on the floor of the Senate, I believe it was October 9th, 2002, when he said, look, if you go after Iraq at the expense of Al-Qaeda, you're encouraging more attacks on the U.S. You're allowing our focus to be misdirected here. And he told his colleagues that the blood's going to be on your hands. Ever since then, he was the first to start attacking the president on the issue of the war in Iraq, he was attacking the president's credibility on that front before attacking the credibility became cool. So he's been doing it for a while now. Whether Kerry thinks that it's a wise choice to let him do it full time, I guess we'll find out in a month or two.
Yes, SV, on Meet the Press, you reproduce it here. Tim Russert, this is September 2002. Tim Russert flashed on the screen a snippet from Bob Graham, one of Bob Graham's diaries. You say in your book he has 450 pounds of diaries going back forever. Anyway, 6:50 awake at 3 Standard Time, weight 181, 6:50, 7 o'clock, apply scalp medication, 7:40, kitchen, brew coffee, prepare and drink breakfast, soy, skim milk, OJ, peach, banana, blueberries, read post, dress in gray suit. And then Russet said, this has been called neurotic, obsessive, bizarre. How would you explain to the American people why you keep such minute detail of what you do every day?
Well, that's true, and it's great sport to make fun of these notebooks. And it's probably to Bob Graham's chagrin that he even allowed reporters to look at them in the first place. But nonetheless, you know, as I point out in the book, yes, he had all those things. And then he also had the number of notes. In fact, the vast majority of the notes from that date were on issues having to do with the drug problem, the terrorism problem, a review of the Apalachicola River and forest environmental issues, amendments he was going to co-sponsor, people who are going to try to help line up votes on, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So, yes, he puts goofy things in his notebooks, and you got to wonder what joy he gets out of it. Nonetheless, as an organizational tool, you know, they've made him pretty much know what's going on in his office all the time for the last 38 years. So, you know, I mean, everyone from Maureen Dowd in 1987 forward has kind of made fun of the notebooks I included in this book. But, you know, still, he seems to derive some real policy value from them, and they're really not hurting anybody else. So I'm not sure what the real downside is.
All right. S.V. Date, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
S.V. is the Capitol Bureau Chief for the Palm Beach Post in Florida. Let's go to one of our callers now. We want to hear from Andrew, who's on the line from Medford, Massachusetts. Hi, Andrew. Who's your pick?
My pick would be Dennis Kucinich. I think that one of the things that Kerry needs to do is to pick a vice president who appeals more to the voters on the left side, liberal side of the party. Those who've been supporting Kucinich and Governor Dean and the other former candidates who are to the left, and try to get them more rejuvenated and get them interested more in Kerry's campaign and help kind of balance him out.
All right. Well, Andrew, thanks for the call. And Jack, you are nodding your head at what, the originality of the idea, or you think he's got a point there?
Well, I just think that would be pretty feckless electorally. I mean, there isn't a liberal vote that he's not going to get, except for those who
maybe
fools
some Nader
who go
people.
For Ralph Nader. Forgive me for the editorial comment, but I understand the gesture, and Dennis was on this program, and he's certainly a very principled man. But I just don't think that would help.
All right,
that would be. Arguably the boldest thing that John Kerry ever did before he lost the presidential election. You can't go that direction. You've got to go toward the center. I mean, you lean to the left, you lean to the right, and then you come back towards the center, and either you go for the geographic balance, which may be in play this year. I wrote a couple of op-eds with Bob Graham, Senator Graham. I wonder whether I'm in those notebooks. Had conversations.
I would imagine if he's recording, you know, what time he's making coffee, I think you've got to be in there, Paul.
No, I had conversation with Weirdo, writing op-ed with me, that kind of thing. I mean, I shudder to think about it. You know, I mean, Florida, yeah, that's a good call. There's a lot of appeal to somebody like Bill Richardson, who might draw Hispanics to the polls in record numbers, and that could help you in a number of different places. I mean, this is a year for balance, I think.
Actually, Paul, I want to pursue that point with Shay Anderson, who is on the line from Albuquerque. He's the state and political reporter for the Albuquerque Tribune. Hi, Shay. You there?
I'm here, yes. Hello.
All right. So time to hear from you. What's the buzz about Bill Richardson? Give us a quick reminder of who he is, and do you think he's interested?
Well, he's our governor of New Mexico, elected just in 2002. Before that, Secretary of Energy. Before that, UN troubleshooter, negotiator all over the world. And before that, congressman from New Mexico for several terms. He's really popular here. And he's also become, with all the speculation about Kerry, he's become popular on the talk show circuit. He's also been a go-to guy. If you need a pundit on international relations, he was barely 5 days into his term as governor here when the North Koreans came knocking on his door in Santa Fe. So he's definitely been in the news a lot, and when this speculation came up, he had to backpedal a lot and was pretty quick to say he wasn't interested in the job, and he's been consistent in saying that.
Do you think he means it?
That's a $64 question. I think, you know, he's been so consistent and public about his denial. He loves to laugh it off, but in private it's beginning to be exasperating to continually get asked the question. And I think that, do I think he means it? I think he means it now, but then again, he hasn't had the call from the nominee saying, will you do it? And there's no predicting what that moment is going to be like.
Is there anybody else out west that we should be keeping our eyes on?
Well, you know, Janet Napolitano is a very popular Democratic governor from Arizona, and she's been seen as a rising star out there. And if you want to go two directions, get a Western governor on the ticket as well as a woman who's popular. She would be the next. She's our next door neighbor, so we think about her a lot.
Hmm. All right, Shay. Well, thank you so much for joining us. Jack and Paul, I'm curious whether either of you think that it would be possible these days to have something happen like the Eagleton affair. The vetting process, I have to assume, is just so much more rigorous now. Paul, maybe you can start us on that point.
Well, I tell you, it is more rigorous, and you really work it hard, but stuff slips through. I can't imagine that you'd have another Eagleton at the same time. It wouldn't surprise me at all. It's just people don't want to come clean with the little things in their background, and that's why you have these vetting teams led by really tough head knockers like Dick Cheney, in the case of the Kerry campaign, Jim Johnson, who's a former Mondale key aide. That's why you have them working this. But you got a really aggressive reporting crew out there working these issues, and if there's anything in the background, boy, it'll come up.
And sometimes, Jack, things that seem little to the candidate or would-be candidate don't look so benign when they're page one.
Or things that seem private, you know, I mean, like Geraldine Ferraro, her husband's business dealings. They didn't have anything to do with her. Or the fact that her husband was renting a property where they owned and rented to a pornographic bookstore, I believe. That had nothing to do with her. That was his business, and yet that was hung on her. And, of course, she had her own problems. But you just don't know what's when the deep frisk comes, it's by the press after the fact, not by the people before the fact who may give you some deference. Oh, of course, that's not so important, Gerald. Right, we don't want it, you know.
All right, we're going to continue our conversation in just a moment. We're talking this hour about picking a vice president. What are John Kerry's options? You can join our conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook, and we're talking this hour about the big VP decision facing John Kerry, about the politics and the consequences of getting the decision right or wrong. Does a running mate influence your vote for president? What are you looking for in your VP? And what does it mean to be vice presidential timber in times of terrorism and war? Who tops your list and why? We invite you to join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And we're talking with Paul Light, presidential scholar at New York University and author of Vice Presidential Power, and with Jack Beatty, our On Point news analyst and senior editor at The Atlantic Monthly. And I want to bring in another caller. Pete's on the line now from Charlottesville, Virginia. Hi, Pete.
Hi, Gail. Good evening. I just wanted to mention, while we're on the subject of vice presidential candidates, I think Max Cleland would be a good one, and I haven't heard him mentioned at all. He brings several attributes. One, he's had government service. He's run for electoral politics as a senator. He's a war veteran, and he's from the South. And I think he would make a great campaigner. And I'd like to think what you all have to think about that.
All right. Thanks, Pete. Paul, you want to start us?
Not bad. I mean, it's not bad. I think that, you know, Kerry's decision calculus here has to do with the fact that whatever he does is going to affect what Bush does. Cleland is a terrific campaigner. I'm still shocked that he was able to be defeated on the basis of patriotism. It's just bizarre. He's
terrific. After having lost, what, three limbs in Vietnam?
But it would certainly challenge sort of a defining characteristic of the Bush campaign, which is that they've been tough during times of great national crisis. I mean, you have two Vietnam War vets, and it would be a powerful ticket in Georgia and so forth.
Jack, do you think it has to be a Southerner?
No. In fact, I mean, I think the world of Max Cleland, and clearly John Kerry does as well. And just seeing Max Cleland on the stage, when he applauds, he takes his right hand and he hits his left shoulder. That's how that man. Every time you see him applaud or move, you think of sacrifice. You think of somebody who's just given everything.
And incredibly articulate, too.
And he can talk a blue streak and very able man. He was the treasurer there before, so he's run statewide before. However, I forget what Bush's margin was in Georgia, but it was double digits anyway. Whereas if you look just to the south, Florida, it was 500 votes. So it would, you know, it would be great to have him on the ticket if, for only one reason. He could turn to Dick Cheney in that debate and quote to Dick Cheney what Dick Cheney said when he was asked why he didn't serve in Vietnam. He said, "I had other priorities."
Mm. And what about Jack Edwards? That's certainly a name that we heard. Obviously, we watched him running for president. And then for a long, not for a long time, in campaign speak, I suppose it's a long time, for several weeks, he was being bandied about as the perfect number two guy. What do you think, Jack?
Well, Edwards was among New Hampshire voters, among Iowa caucus goers, and among several other sampled groups of Democrats in the primary. He was their number one choice for vice president. And he brings you star power. He's got it. Whatever it is, he's got it. On the other hand, he would show up the fact that John Kerry is challenged in the charisma department. And one read I've heard on that is John Forbes Kerry wants to be seen as the JFK of this campaign. He doesn't want his vice president to have that sort of glamour to him.
All right. I want to bring in John Kamen now. He's been waiting patiently on the line. John, thanks. He is the chief political reporter for the Arizona Republic. So, John, fill us in a little bit more. We heard Janet Napolitano's name being mentioned a little earlier in the program. Tell us more about her.
Well, she isn't quite ready for prime time, is the feeling in Arizona. And not because she doesn't have the character or the dynamic and spirited leadership that would inspire national confidence, but she's only been a governor for 15 months, and nobody knows her. She doesn't have that much of a track record. Incidentally, let me tell you that she pronounces her name Napolitano rather than Tano.
Ah. Thank you.
Well, one of her aides recalls a rather amusing argument between her and her brother at the inaugural dinner about the way the family name should be pronounced.
So there's an inter-family argument about that?
Yes, right. The brother thinks that it should be Napolitano, which, of course, is the more Italian way. But Janet comes from New York, and she grew up part of the time in Pittsburgh, and I guess maybe it's the Eastern influence or something.
So she's perhaps on a longer list and not so much on the short list.
I would suspect so. And she doesn't make too much of all of the attention that she's getting. There are probably more people inclined to think that she would be running for Senate in 2006. That's when her gubernatorial term expires. And with that kind of experience behind her, she really could be a major contender for almost any office in the future. Mm. She's only 46 years old and has many years ahead of her.
Well, John, where you are, will people be upset if it's a Southerner and not a Westerner, or is it a different dynamic to that argument?
I don't think that Arizona has any particular preference in that. They will consider the person, and of course John Edwards would be very attractive to many voters across the country. I think Arizona is relatively new to having some real power in this. We're a much bigger state than many people would suspect. We're bigger than in population than Wisconsin and Minnesota and Maryland and coming up on the size of Missouri. So we've got some clout, and our primary election this year was very early, a week after New Hampshire, and Arizona suddenly, at the last minute, kind of came into the sense that, hey, we've got a choice here, and we got to start acting like a bigger state. But I don't think too many people have given an awful lot of thought to whether the vice president should be a Southwesterner or not. I'm sure they would love it.
All right, John. Well, we'll be watching, as you will. Thanks for joining us.
Mm-hmm.
Paul, let me put it to you about some of the other possible bold choices here. Oprah Winfrey, John Lewis.
I'm thinking John McCain. I don't see Oprah Winfrey withstanding the political scrutiny. I mean, I think Americans do set kind of a minimum threshold of political experience, and I just don't think she could pass it. She's got a lot of star appeal, but I don't know. Whether she'd want to enter that kind of fray is another question entirely. I think, you know, Kerry has to consider the impact of his choice on the Bush campaign. Do you want to force Bush's hand so that he makes a pick? You know, the Democrats make the first pick here. They've got to move first. And if you get somebody that shakes things up radically, perhaps Bush then does push Cheney off the ticket and goes for somebody quite radical himself.
Like a Rudy Giuliani or an Elizabeth Dole?
Well, I don't think Elizabeth Dole, but it could be somebody like Giuliani. It could be somebody like Condi Rice, although I'm not sure she's going to come through this September 11th controversy with flying colors here. But, you know, do you want to have a campaign in which you're up against Cheney? And I think the Democrats right now might like a campaign with Cheney still on the ticket. I remember back in January of 2001 when the AP ran a story saying Cheney, Bush grows as leader. Well, the days when Cheney played the role of the great legitimizer of the Bush candidacy are long gone, and his negatives are high, and the American public is concerned about him. He's kind of the Velcro vice president, and you might want to make a choice that keeps him on the ticket. This is all part of a decision calculus that these folks really do play through. They're constantly polling, focus grouping, trying to figure out how this all is going to play out. The problem for Kerry is that Bush moves second, and that is really part of the calculus.
That certainly makes it more of a risk. Let's throw some more names in. We've got Steve on the line from Duluth, Minnesota. Hi, Steve. Who would you suggest?
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm still waiting for some big shooter names here. I mean, I've heard of Bill Richardson, but I'm thinking of names like the past Cuomo, Mondale. I would like to see Cohen, but I wonder if something bold like Hillary Clinton would be something to do.
Because?
Well, she's one of the central figures in the Democratic Party. I guess that's what I'm looking for. I'm looking for some real big names that people recognize. That's the problem. I think that they're, you know, the choice of like Richardson would be the recognition is low, but somebody like Hillary, everybody knows.
All right, Steve. Thanks so much for the call, Jack. What do you make of that?
Well, she's made she hasn't really made a Sherman-esque statement about this, I don't think.
You know, certainly positioned her well for 2008.
That's right. I mean, she hasn't just said ruled it out, as far as I know. I mean, completely, irrevocably. That said, I mean, you're going to carry New York State anyway. If you're not, it's not even going to be a close election. And on the other hand, she would fire up every voter who's going to vote for Kerry, who would do so because she was, well, he's already got that vote, and I don't see that she really would add anything there. But I see how she would polarize and really energize the Republican base, who see her as a sort of symbol of everything they're against: independent women, you know, her role as sort of alter ego to to Satan, a.k.a. Bill Clinton. I mean,
and what is your take on that, Paul? I mean, is one of the calculations here inevitably going to be don't get the other folks so riled up that it works against you?
Yeah, that's part of it. But it's also, can you stand being vice president for 8 years? Hillary Clinton watched Al Gore spend those 8 years standing 3 feet to the right or left of Bill Clinton at every event. I mean, Gore was the loyal politician and then lost. And I think Hillary Clinton has presidential ambitions. This is one of those things that plays out all the time about whether or not somebody wants to get on the ticket, what their calculation is about the possibility that Kerry does get elected. Vice president is a very good job to have if you want to be president someday. It's not a very good job to have if you want to be president right after your president leaves office. That's the lesson for Gore. And George H.W. Bush was the first vice president elected to the presidency since Martin Van Buren. I mean, it's a long way back. Mm. So she's got to be thinking that as well.
All right. I think we have time for one more call. Let's go to Somerville, Massachusetts, and hear from Steve. Hi, Steve.
Hello. I'm actually concerned about John Kerry choosing someone who would be an obvious political calculation. I think that if he does that, even, you know, a Florida senator or something like that, that diminishes the choice he's making. I'd like to see him choose someone like John Breaux of Louisiana, who actually would be an excellent president. And you'd also get, you know, the bonus of probably winning Louisiana, and you'd also appeal to Southerners more broadly and independent-minded folks and independent-minded Republicans. But people like John Edwards and some of these others who've been mentioned, I really don't think are ready to be president, and somebody like John Breaux is.
All right, Steve. Appreciate the call. Thank you. Paul and Jack, in the couple of minutes that we have left, I want to talk for just a second about the downside of making an announcement now, because there are many people who feel as if this is already a permanent campaign. So if an announcement came now, then we would have 7 months where we knew pretty much everything but how people were actually going to vote. And is that a good thing, or does that turn people off even more to the political process, Jack?
In other words, it leaves something in suspense.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah. Well, first, as to Breaux, I mean, I think the rap on him is he is very strongly anti-abortion. The Democrats would not do that. That is just the litmus of that party. That won't happen, for good or ill. Yes, keep him in the seats. But on the other hand, look at Kerry. He's got a bad arm. He's going to have he's off the campaign trail for a week. If he had named somebody, that guy's out there campaigning, getting in the news. And so I don't know. Is he going to have more pulled tendons? Stay off those ski slopes. At least the winter is over. Keep the guy in one piece.
Paul, how would you argue that? More of an upside to announce now than a downside?
Well, I think, you know, you only have so many surprises, so many big media events, and I think you want to hold on to this. I think you want to hold it until as close to the convention as possible. Therefore, Kerry will make an announcement tomorrow.
All right. Paul Light, thank you so much for being with us.
It's a pleasure.
Jack Beatty, thank you, as always.
Thank you.
And you can continue the conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on Forums. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.